This is Florida Matters. I'm Robin Sessingham. These are very exciting times for eating out in Tampa Bay. Our cuisine is getting better and more varied and starting to draw national attention. I recently moderated a panel on international dining at the St. Petersburg Conference on World Affairs held at USF St. Pete. And joining me in the conversation were Laura Riley, restaurant critic for the Tampa Bay Times, Janet Keeler. Janet teaches journalism at USF St. Pete and is the founder and coordinator of the Graduate Food Writing and Photography Certificate Program, and she's the former food editor at the Tampa Bay Times, and Emmanuel Roux, who has owned several restaurants in St. Petersburg and now owns Gâteau au Chocolat, a flourless chocolate cake bakery. Roux also runs the 15th Street Agrihood, an organic educational farm in downtown St. Petersburg.
It's said that traveling makes us broader-minded. And I'm wondering about trying the food and drink of other countries. I mean, does that change us in any way? Emmanuel, what do you think?
I think that food is a very important part of culture. We expand our horizons when we try new flavors and also new methods of cooking.
Janet?
One of the things I do here at USF St. Pete is I lead a study abroad to France and Germany. We study travel writing and food writing and kind of mesh them together. And it's amazing to take students that haven't really experienced the world so much and to see what they're eating. One year we took a student who, when I got there, had told me she'd never had soup. She'd never had...
Soup?
Yeah. She'd never had cheese that wasn't a cheese stick, fried cheese stick. She'd never, you know, had a burrito. It was, like, amazing. But we got her to try raw oysters and all kinds of different things. She was game to do everything, and now she wants to write about food, and now she'll eat everything. So that was an expansive thing for her that wouldn't have happened, I don't think, if she had been traveling.
What do you think, Laura?
Well, I think that part of the reason I write about food is that I'm just super nosy, and it's a way to get into people's homes, into their habits, into the things that are hugely important to them. If you think about all the things food accompanies in human endeavor, I mean, try dating without food, try mourning without food. Any holiday has enormous and elaborate food rituals associated with it. And they're different in every culture. And I think that how we eat and what we eat in what order says a lot about our values, our history, our culture. You know, I think Janet and I probably both agree that there's no story that can't be told through food.
What's the best example in the Tampa Bay area in St. Petersburg, do you think? What's the best international dining right now?
Well, I think before I want to answer that, I want to say, if we think about how far we've come in the Tampa Bay area in the past 10 or 15 years, 15 years ago, this area was a proving ground for chain concepts. We had just the right demographics of slightly gastronomically timid older white people that, you know, we were like, if it plays in Peoria, that we were Peoria. Yeah. And I think it's remarkable how much that's not the case now, how demographically we've changed, how much we've broadened. I mean, we had, until, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, there were whole continents that didn't have any culinary representation here. There was no African cuisine here until 7 or 8 years ago. And I think that we've seen just an explosion of breadth in terms of cuisine. You know, you go down Armenia now and it's Restaurant Row of affordable Southeast Asian, Latin American, South American cuisines. I think that there are pockets all around the Tampa Bay area. But even just downtown St. Pete now, there are probably 25, 30 different cuisines represented one way or another. I mean, not always authentically or the way you'd find it in the home country, but it's been a dramatic shift, I think, in just the past half dozen years.
Yeah, and you say that other states, other newspapers, they're noticing.
Oh, yeah, we've been the kind of media darling this past year. And Forbes and Food & Wine and, you know, any number of publications have looked to us as this emerging market.
Yeah, that's interesting. What do you think, Janet? Why are things changing?
Shout out to the millennials who want to try new things. And that's changed a lot of the way we eat and what's going on out there. If you notice, restaurants are louder. They're more like parties. There's a lot of hard surfaces in there that don't absorb sound. And that's a fun time for young people. And so that's changed a lot of things. But they're looking, I think, for stories and the story of Outback, the story of Applebee's, the story of Chili's, not that interesting. So these smaller independent restaurants, they have stories to them. The chef has a story. They read about his story or her story. And so that's of interest to them. And I think that's helped the growth of independent restaurants.
So millennials and also just population growth.
When I moved to St. Petersburg in 1992, there was not a restaurant on Beach Drive. Think about that. There was not a restaurant on Beach Drive. And I moved here from Northern California, and the first, I don't know, 5-6 years, I thought, what have I done? There wasn't much downtown. There was a couple of places. And so the explosion of everything downtown is amazing to me. It's amazing. And it's such a beautiful spot, so it makes sense, right? The waterfront and everything, it's a beautiful place.
So, Emmanuel, you've owned restaurants since 1993 in this area. What have you seen?
I remember one day at Redwoods, we had a couple that came. They wanted real lettuce. And what they meant by that was iceberg. And, you know, they say that those are weeds. And, well, they're pretty close. But that was very revealing. I think that there has been a tremendous change in the demographics in St. Petersburg. Dining was, when I came, fulfilling a physiological need, and it has turned to be a different experience. I remember a week ago, I was running some errands, and I was going to Largo, and I said, where am I going to have lunch? The three places that came to mind was a Filipino restaurant, a dim sum, and a Mexican restaurant that is in a former gas station. So this was absolutely inconceivable in 1993 when I came, where hummus was, you know, a revolution.
So our palate is changing, and people are becoming, thanks to millennials or just some of us older people who are growing, maybe, our palate's becoming a little more adventurous. We're willing to try new things. But I think the chefs also probably have to move towards our palate as well, in a way. And I'm wondering how they do that. Did you ever find that you had to Americanize your recipes or your menu?
We really tried not to, because I don't know how to Americanize something. And I think that it is a disservice to do it. You know, you just throw something on the wall and see what sticks.
So you grew up in Tunisia on a farm.
Between Tunisia and France.
Yeah, yes. Back and forth. Your parents were French expatriates.
That's correct, yes.
And you grew up on a farm.
Our farm was 20 miles outside of Tunis, and every weekend, you know, we had a lot of friends coming. Normally, when everybody left, they would pull in front of the kitchen, and our cook and our gardener would put a basket of fresh vegetables in every car that was leaving. You know, so sharing food was really part of life. And I think this is what I enjoy now doing, is that I love when people come to the agri-hood and that we share things that we have grown from seeds. And this is the experience. And I think that this is the next step. People want to know where the food comes from. And this is the local food movement that Laura has spoke about. The chefs want to put a face, want to humanize food. And I think that that is, after the ethnic movement, that is the next thing.
Can I just speak to what Janet was saying about millennials before? I think that that's a really true thing, that millennials have contributed a lot. A lot of them lived here, went away to college, said, I'm never moving back to the Tampa Bay area, and then they did. And part of why they did that is that there's still affordable real estate here. There's still cheap money to be borrowed, often from mom and dad, to start a kind of an entrepreneurial business. There's been a lot of plucky DIY entrepreneurialism amongst millennials. And I attribute some of that, a subset of that, to the rise of craft beer. I think craft beer has been enormously important in the changing our food scene here. And I attribute some of that directly to Joey Redner, and maybe even to his father, I think. You know, but Joey Redner at Cigar City brought craft beer to the Tampa Bay area, and more than that, he had this kind of spirit of cooperation and co-opetition. So a lot of other brewers after him got their start using his equipment. He allowed a lot of other brewers to kind of experiment and then kind of go out on their own. So he kind of was responsible for the explosion of craft beer here, which in turn brought a lot of millennial attention. And I mean, food and beer go hand in hand, and which is the chicken, which is the egg, is a little, can go either way. But I think craft beer and the rise of craft beer turned a lot of people's attention to food.
So next time you're at a good restaurant, you can thank Joey Redner.
Yeah.
Are you seeing a lot of Florida food being used, Emmanuel? I read somewhere that 80% of our food in Florida is brought in from out of state. So I'm wondering how much we really do make use of our own produce, seafood.
I think it varies according to the season. You know, we're going into a strawberry time. There is times where you get romaine from Canada, but there is other times where you get romaine from California, and there is a lot of romaine grown in Florida. So it changes depending on the time of the year, because most of the chain restaurants and a lot of restaurants want to have the same thing available all the time because they have it on their menu. They don't want to change the menu. I think that there are still things that are undiscovered. I experimented with sea grapes, for example.
Pits are so big, though. There's hardly any fruit on that.
Yes, but I think that it's only a matter of time before a bartender makes a cocktail with sea grapes that would be unique to the area. Nobody has done it yet. I've played with it to try it. So there are some resources that are available. There is also, at this time of year, we can grow a lot of things that are grown in the summer in other parts of the U.S. and in other parts of the world. So I planted some cress. We'll see if there are any takers for it. So there's still a lot of ways to try new things.
So, Janet, do you think there's any international cuisines that just do not have an audience in Tampa Bay? I'd like your take on that too, Laura, that just are too far out there.
I don't. And I, at this stage in the game, and Laura would have a better handle on that, mm-hmm. but at this stage in the game, I just figure anything's game. People are willing to try anything. You know, there's so much travel around the world. You know, we're so interested in food. I mean, look at, you know, the Food Network, the way it's expanded and what we know about food. We know a lot about food. We may not know how to cook, but we do know a lot about food, right? We know all these terms, you know, chiffonade and all these kinds of things. We can throw them around. We don't do them, but we do know about them. I think people are sort of interested in everything. And this idea of, I mean, it's to me a very American thing to have all this fusion stuff, putting different cuisines together.
So I have my wish list, you know, of cuisines that I'd love to see here. But first of all, I'd like to say, it's been so cool to see things like Korean food be embraced. I think that Americans have been very slow to realize the allures or the loveliness of bitter and fermented flavors. I mean, the idea of kimchi 5 years ago was a stretch for a lot of people, and I think that we've seen a real pivot in terms of our embrace of fermented flavors as a contrast to, you know, salty, sweet, et cetera. So that's been kind of nice to see a whole bunch of successful Korean restaurants. I still think there are swaths of Southeast Asia that we really have underrepresented. I mean, Singaporean cuisine is amazing, and you see little pockets of it. Northern California has a big kind of community. And, you know, I think there are some cuisines we see a lot of, like Thai, and that's partly because the Thai government historically has been a huge promoter of its cuisine to the rest of the world. Whereas you don't see Laotian or Cambodian cuisine nearly as much, even though they're geographically similar and you know, share a lot of commonalities. They're not cuisines that have been exported as vigorously as Thai cuisine, say. And still, I mean, Africa is an enormous continent with a lot of breadth and depth in terms of ingredient use. And I think there's a lot of reason to think that there could be a surge in interest, partly because it's a little more veggie focused with meat as a kind of an accent rather than a center of the plate. And I think that's something we're seeing a ton more of just day to day in restaurants.
You mentioned access to ingredients, and I was thinking if that was one reason why maybe we didn't see some kinds of cuisines, if they're rely a lot on sea urchins or some kind of ingredient that we could find, but it's harder to find or that we just don't have easy access to.
I think at this point you can get anything anywhere. Whether we should is another question that deserves a lot of thought and conversation. If you go to Noble Rice in Tampa, Eric Frolick over there is sourcing all of his fish and sea urchins and, you know, whatever from Japan. And, you know, very meticulously sourced. So he is, you know, brings stuff in from Tokyo 3-4 times a week. So it's possible, I think, because of the magic of FedEx and all the ways that we get our food now, you can get anything anytime, whether we should. I mean, it used to be that everyone lived farm to table, everyone lived seasonally. You know, that's because there wasn't an alternative to that. And now it's, we can have what we want when we want it all the time. And there are some problems with that.
Are there any international cuisines that have just oversaturated the market? Like, why is Italian so ubiquitous rather than Scandinavian?
Well, I think it's cheaper to make, for one thing. I mean, pasta is a very affordable thing to make, and I think that Americans embraced it pretty fast and furiously. I think that there's a lot of mediocre sushi in this market, and you know, I'm hoping that maybe that'll scale back at some point.
Any thoughts, Emmanuel, about kinds of international cuisine that are on the rise or on the wane?
I definitely think that French is on the wane.
Really?
Sadly.
Because the idea of a formal French meal is something that millennials are not interested in anymore, or they may be, but on a special occasion. The idea of 3 or 4 or 5 courses is gone. Now people want to have a beer from a particular brewery, as we were talking before, and a Cuban sandwich from down the street. And the person next to you will be ordering something, dim sum or some Korean barbecue. It is much more informal, and French cooking and French meals are very formal. I think that people want now an experience. And having people coming from many different parts of the country, parts of the world, you have that stew that is taking place here that is very interesting and exciting, but it is changing the way we eat.
Are we becoming more internationalized than other countries are? I'm just going to admit something and make myself sound a little silly, but so I was staying with friends in Italy. Every lunch was Italian food, and dinner was Italian food, and the next day was Italian food, and dinner was Italian food. And we're not used to that, right? So much of one kind of thing. You know, right. We're used to having Mexican one night and Italian the next night, and then, I don't know, just bake a chicken or something. But I found, wow, when you live in Italy, you really just eat Italian food all the time.
I think it is true everywhere you go in the world that international choice is really purely American. Mm-hmm. Because even in France, yes, you can have sushi, you can have Chinese, whatever, but 90% of the time people eat French food. Because it is so part of the culture, and you're happy with your culture, why do you want to go somewhere else?
But don't you think that something that has made this country what it is a seeking novelty?
Right.
You know, I think that that's something that is a uniquely American trait, and it certainly extends to what we eat and how we eat. I think that there's always this kind of moving forward, what's the next newest thing? I think, you know, at this point, when you talk to your friends, there's a lot of like, where have you eaten? Kind of what's the next exciting thing? And I think that that's a part of the culture that we have, is this quest or this lust for the next thing.
But I think that also there is a danger with that when you experiment for the experience sake. Mm-hmm. I remember when my father came to the U.S. in the 60s, he came back and he was in Chicago and he ended up with a dish with whipped cream and there was an anchovy on top of it. You know, I remember some very questionable dishes that were in trendy restaurants in Tampa in the late 80s, just wild experimentation. Well, it has a value, but will it survive the test of time and become a classic? No.
Things are classic for a reason.
Exactly.
Right. So is there a kind of American cuisine besides just seeking the novelty?
I don't think so. I think that we were the center of the kind of molecular gastronomy movement in Chicago, and that's kind of been debunked, or people have fallen out of love with that. So I think that there have been moments where we have a kind of cohesive idea of what this is, what the future of gastronomy in this country looks like. But I would say right at this moment, it's very fractured. Just the incorporation of international ingredients across the board, I think, means there's always this kind of cacophony of different things going on simultaneously. So I don't think so.
Janet, what do you think?
You know, I think at one time I might have said Southern cuisine.
I would say Southern, but if you start comfort food.
Yeah, but if you start deconstructing that, a lot of that is from other places. So much of our cuisine has come from immigrants. You know, watermelon comes from Africa. And I would agree with Laura that there's not really, I wouldn't say an indigenous cuisine here. You know, I look at the bowl of gumbo as sort of a very, you know, representative look at the United States in a lot of ways. If you look at what's in there and where all these ingredients came from, and even the word gumbo comes from the West African word for okra. The idea of the melting pot, which I don't totally love. I don't want us to melt altogether. But I like to look at it more like a pizza. You know, we have one foundation, but a lot of different toppings. You know, there's pockets of innovation, but I wouldn't say there's a real super distinct American cuisine, and just sort of like I would say there's not necessarily like a super distinct American. You know, we've made up a lot of different kinds of people and a lot of different kinds of food, which is the greatness, I think.
I think I'm going to open it up for if anybody feels like they have any questions for our panel.
Thank you. George Lang from Tampa. MacDill Air Force Base. Once a year, there's an international coalition night there where all the members of the coalition, 45 plus, come together to serve cuisines from their country. And a very interesting opportunity. While my wife and I have traveled much, we've had the opportunity to partake in a lot of different places that likelihood will never be. But I think with the military, who have been around the world and dealing with this, learned to love a lot of different foods. So I don't know if you believe that's maybe an influence in our community different from others.
Absolutely. If you look at the Ballast Point neighborhood in Tampa, kind of very South Tampa, there are tons of Middle Eastern restaurants, and they're there to service the people who spent time in the Middle East at MacDill. Same with German restaurants in this area. Almost any German restaurant you go to, if you just start eavesdropping on the next table, it's former military who were stationed in West Germany years ago or Germany more recently. But I think that's a really good point, is that we have a group of people here who have been very transient in their lives and have lived other places and want access to those cuisines.
Hi, I'm Pat Fling. I live in St. Petersburg now. I'm a transplant. I've lived all over the country. And I think it's not just millennials who are bringing diversity to international eating, but it's people coming here to retire because we're more educated maybe than Native Floridians have been in the past. No knock on Native Floridians, but I think people are coming here with a broader perspective, have lived all over, have traveled widely. So when I go out to eat, I see a lot of people who have transplanted here from all over who are more my age necessarily than millennials. But one of the things that I feel is missing in St. Pete is a daily farmers market. I know we have the big farmers market on Saturdays, but there's really not that many farmers market kind of places you could go to any day of the week. I miss that having lived in other states.
Where did you move from?
Most recently from Reno, Nevada.
Okay, so you know, part of the issue here is, you know, you've moved to the most densely populated county in the state. So there's not a lot of farmers around here. You know, there's some down in Bradenton, some out in Hillsborough. So when you start talking about like a daily farmers market, where are we going to get the produce from? You know, now we're talking about trucking it in from a long way, and then you start getting into that issue of the gasoline you're spending. So we're kind of in a tough place, I think, for a daily big kind of farmer's market. You know, I know that area. I'm from Northern California near Sacramento, which is, of course, you know, fantastic agriculture area.
And I don't want to come across as a Publix booster, but, you know, their Florida-grown, Florida-fresh sections have gotten a lot bigger in the last few years. I think they're trying to compete with some of these places. And so I'm having an easier time because we don't have farmer's markets every day. You go to the grocery store and I'm having an easier time finding local zucchini, the local strawberries, things like that.
And we have collard the upside-down growing season. You know, yeah. If you come from other parts of the country, Wisconsin and New Jersey and all these places that people come from to move here, you're used to those fantastic things happening in August. stone fruit, tomatoes, corn, all that kind of stuff. We're, you know, if you can maybe get mangoes in South Florida, we don't. That's not our growing season. So it's a little bit getting used to, too, I think, for people.
Hal Friedman, St. Petersburg. I grew up in Manhattan and lived in San Francisco for many years, so I'm used to a certain kind of food, and I agree with her, it's where you come from. One of the things that you said about stories, I think there's also the accessibility. There's a lot of young couples, millennial couples, that have started restaurants here. Mm-hmm. Lolita's Brick and Mortar, Il Ritorno. I think that there's an accessibility on a human basis, not just the story behind them, but they're people. Mm-hmm. I don't really relate to Outback, you know, because it's a corporation.
It's a different time.
I might buy the stock, but I wouldn't know who I'm dealing with. That's a statement. Question, why don't we have any decent Chinese food here?
I think that's a really good question. So there is some decent Chinese food in Tampa, on the Tampa side, but Pinellas County has always been super challenged. I mean, ABC is about as good as it gets in Pinellas. Obviously, it must have to do with demographics. I still think there's so much room for a big kind of Hong Kong-style kind of splurge night Chinese somewhere in St. Pete, you know, especially because we do have access to great fish. You know, like, what's better than a whole fish with, you know, like ginger scallion, and you know, I mean, it's such a great cuisine at its highest level. So yeah, that's always been a mystery to me, and hope springs eternal.
Thank you all very much, and thank you to our panelists.
That's it for today's show. I've been speaking with food journalist Laura Riley and Janet Keeler and restaurateur Emmanuel Rue. Thank you so much for joining us. We want to let you know that Florida Matters is now available as a podcast. In the podcast, you'll hear more of this conversation about the importance of keeping our food local, plus how chefs put a Florida spin on their dishes. Search for it wherever you get your podcasts or go to the website WUSF.org and click the Listen tab. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. The producer is Stephanie Colombini. I'm Robin Sessingham. Thanks for listening.